Last time we finished the seven universal Chetasikas. So Chetasikas are divided into different groups. And the first group is called Anya Samana, common to another. And there are 13 Anya Samana Chetasikas. And they are divided into two subgroups. The first is called Sabba Chitta Sadharana, common to all chittas. There are seven. And the next group is called Pakkinnaka. And Pakkinnaka, today we will study, begin our study with Pakkinnakas. So Pakkinnakas are those chittasikas that accompany both kusala and akusala, and also other chetas, but not with all kusala or akusala chetas. So that is why they are called Pakkinnaka. And in the Venerable Narada's book, they are translated as particulars. But here in this manual, they are called occasionals. That means they arise occasionally with kusala or akusala and so on. So these six chetasikas arise with many chetas, but not with all chetas. So they will arise with some chetas and they will not arise with other chetas. And there are six of them. So the first is vitakka, the second vichara, the third adhimokha, fourth viriya, fifth piti, and sixth chanda. We have met vitakka, vichara, and piti among the jhana factors. So vitakka is included in jhana factors, so is vichara and piti. So the first one, vitakka, is the chetasika which takes the mind to the object, or vitakka is the application of the mind to the object, so putting the mind onto the object. Its characteristic is the directing of the mind onto the object. Its function is to strike at and thrash the object. That means to act upon the object. And then it is manifested as the leading of the mind onto the object. The same thing. And proximate cause is not mentioned in the commentaries. So it may be the object which is the proximate cause of vitakka. Now, vitakka arises with 55 types of consciousness. But vitakka accompanying all those 55 types of consciousness are not called jhana. So, only vitakka accompanying some types of consciousness are called jhana. Now, vitakka can be developed or cultivated so that it becomes a factor. It becomes strong, a strong factor. And then it is called a jhana. And in the manual, you will see that it is then termed appana. Now, this is another technical term you have to remember, appana. Appana is a name for jhana as well as maggas and phala. So in the fourth chapter, the word this appana will be used. So in there, sometimes appana will mean just the rupa vajra jhanas and arupa vajra jhanas. Sometimes it may mean lokudra chetas also. So here, vitakka is called, sometimes called, appana. that is absorption of the mind in the object. So applying the mind closely to the object. And then vitaka is also called sankappa, intention. And as such is distinguished as miccha sankappa and samma sankappa. Wrong intention or wrong thought and right thought. Wrong thought means thoughts about sensual pleasures, thoughts about injuring others, thoughts about dosa, ill will, hate. And samasankappa is the opposite of these three. Thoughts about getting out of mental sensual pleasures, thoughts about non-injuring others, and thoughts about non-hatred. And samasankappa is actually one of the factors of the noble path. So vitaka has many meanings, many names, depending on what function it does. And the second one is vichara. You already know vichara. It is a characteristic of continued pressure on the object. Vitaka put the mind on the object, and vichara keeps it there, engaged on the mind. Engaged on the object in the sense of examining it. So it is something like examining the object. That is why sometimes it is close to panya. Its function is sustained application of the associated mental phenomena to the object. It is manifested as the anchoring of those phenomena in the object, so keeping the object keeping the mind on the object. The object may be understood to be its proximate cause. Here also, the commentary does not give the proximate cause of vichara. Sometimes, he wrote so much about vitaka and vichara that he might have forgotten to give us the proximate cause of vitaka and vichara. So they are not mentioned. The difference between vitaka and vichara has been discussed above. So you all know the difference between vitaka and vichara, right? What is the one example? Oh, yes, the bee diving towards the flower, that is like vitaka, and vichara is like the bee hovering on the flower, right? Or an airplane taking off, and then when it reaches this cruising altitude, right? Yeah. Now, the third one, adhimokkha. It is translated as decision. Now, this word literally means releasing of the mind onto the object. That means actually decision. Decision or resolution. It dwells on the object and make a decision, the decision that it is the object, something like that. And it is compared to a stone pillar owing to its unshakable resolve regarding the object. So it is compared to a rock pillar, which is steady, which is strong, which does not move, because it cannot be shaked. So adhimokkha is like that, dwelling on the object firmly. Sometimes, later we'll come to saddha, faith. Sometimes saddha is also described as adhimokkha. But in that case, adhimokkha is not this adhimokkha, but it is saddha. But here it is a distinct mental factor called adhimokkha or decision. And the fourth one is virya. You are already familiar with the word virya and the thing which is virya itself. So because without virya, you cannot practice meditation. Its characteristic is supporting exertion and marshalling. And it is mental energy. It is not, here, it is not physical energy. So when we say, I make effort, then I may make physical effort, or I may make mental effort. But the virya here means the mental. Its function is to support its associated states. So with the help of virya, the associated states can be on the object, and they are reinforced by this virya or energy. Its manifestation is non-collapse. That means when something is supported, then it doesn't collapse. So when a house becomes old and shaky, then you put some timber or somewhere to support it, to reinforce it, something like that. Its proximate cause is a sense of urgency or a ground for arousing energy, that is, anything that stirs one to vigorous action. Now, sometimes we have these, what are called ground for arousing energy. That means something like that. Let's say, I will have to do something tomorrow, though today I will practice meditation. So when I'm doing that something tomorrow, I won't be able to practice. So I will practice today, something like that. And then after doing that job, that you say, while I was doing that job, I couldn't practice meditation. Now is the time for me to practice meditation, like that. So you encourage yourself, say, taking some situation as an encouragement. So this is called the ground for arousing energy. So when there are grounds for arousing energy, you arouse the energy. The ground for energy is said to be the proximate cause of virya. Just as new timbers added to an old house prevent it from collapsing, or just as a strong reinforcement enables the king's army to defeat the enemy, so energy upholds and supports all the associated states and does not allow them to recede. So long as there is energy, you will not give up. You will not drop out. Once energy is low, or once energy is non-existent, then you fall away from meditation. So energy is very important. It is actually one of the mental faculties, right? How many mental faculties are there regarding practice of meditation? Five, yeah. So virya is one of them, right? Can you name the other four? Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, right? Very good. So energy is one of the mental faculties which we have to arouse and develop, especially, say, when we practice meditation. And this energy is said to burn the mental defilements. That is why sometimes it is called atapa. In the sutta on Mahasiddhipatthana Sutta, Buddha used this word again and again, atapi, atapi, sampajano, satima, and so on. So that means the monk having effort or making effort. So it is called there atapa. Atapa means heat. So it heats up. I mean, heats up means it burns up the mental defilements. So when there is virya, mental defilements are burnt up. So it is very important factor in the practice of meditation. And the next one is piti. So you all know that it's translated as joy, happiness, zest. What else? Pleasurable interest, rapture. Yeah, zest here. So it is one of the jhana factors. And piti is not feeling, right? Piti is not feeling. So its characteristic is endearing the associated states. So when there is piti, the mind is happy, the mind is elated or something like that. So it is endeared. Its function is to refresh mind and body. So when there is piti, you are refreshed. Or its function is to pervade, to thrill with rapture. When you really experience piti, the whole of your body seems to be soaked in something like oil or water or something like that. And mind and body is its proximate cause. Because when there is no mind and body, piti cannot arise. So mind and body, nama and rupa, are said to be its proximate cause. And the last one is desire, chanda. Formerly it was translated as conation. I don't know which is better, desire or conation. So it is a simple desire, a mere will to do. It is not desire as attachment, as craving, as lust. So chanda here means desire to act. That is to perform an action or achieve some result. This kind of desire must be distinguished from desire in the reprehensible sense, that is, from lobha, greed, and raga, lust. When we want to be specific, then we use kamachanda. Kamachanda is one of the five mental hindrances. There are five mental hindrances, right? The first one is kamachanda. There, kamachanda means lobha. But here, chanda is neutral, or it is variable. When it is with akusala, it can be akusala, and when it is with kusala, it is kusala. So it is just a mere will to do. And it is... its characteristic is what? Just desire to act. And its function is searching for an object. Want an object like that. And its manifestation is need for an object, and that same object is its proximate cause. Because without an object, consciousness and also mental factors cannot arise. It should be regarded as a stretching forth of the mind's hands towards the object. Now, it is compared to a man stretching out his hand to pick up an arrow, an archer. When he wants to shoot an arrow, he picks up an arrow from the tube. So, he is not attached to the arrow. He does not want to keep the arrow, but he wants to pick up the arrow so that he can shoot. So chanda is like that. It is just a mere will to do. not attachment, not lust, not craving. Sometimes we use the word dhammachanda. That means desire to practice dhamma. So these are called pakinyaka, right? Yeah. Occasionals. So they will arise with or only with some types of consciousness, not with all. Later on, you will look at the chart and not today, later. So we will find out how many types of consciousness arise with vitaka, vichara, and so on. Seven universals and six occasionals make 13 mental factors, and these 13 are called anya samana, ethically variables. That means they can go along with both kusala and akusala. The next group is akusala. You already know akusala. So unwholesome mental factors. Actually, these are the factors that make a type of consciousness unwholesome. You know, consciousness is without color. It's like clear water. And you put a color in it, and the water becomes red or green or blue or yellow. So in the same way, consciousness or citta has no color. It's just the awareness of the object, but when it arises together with some of these akusala cetasikas, then it is called an akusala citta. So actually the mental factors are those that make one type of consciousness different from another type of consciousness. So when we come to study the combination of cetas and cetasikas, it will become clearer. And the four akusala cetasikas are divided into how many groups? Sabba kusala sadharana, for unwholesome universals, greed triad, hatred quartet, and sloth diet, and then doubt alone. So the first four are called unwholesome universals. That means these four arise with all 12 types of unwholesome consciousness. So whenever an unwholesome consciousness arises, these four are always with that consciousness. And these four are 1, moha, 2, ahirika, 3, anottaba, and 4, uddhaccha. Moha is delusion. Moha is a synonym for avidya. Now you met the word avidya in what? Dependent, but it's just a more about a dependent origination. So avidya and moha are synonyms, so they mean the same thing, the mental factor, and it is also translated as ignorance. And its characteristic is mental blindness or unknowing. So it is blindness. That means not knowing or not understanding the true nature of things. It may understand wrongly, but it will not understand correctly. Its function is non-penetration. So when there is moha, we cannot penetrate into the nature of things. When there is moha, we do not see the true nature of things. So when we practice meditation, we try not to let moha enter our minds. So if we let the moha enter our mind, when moha is in our mind, then we cannot see the true nature of things. So its function is non-penetration or concealment of the real nature of the object. It is like a blindfold. So when you are blindfolded, you don't see things. In the same way, when moha is blindfolding us, we do not see their true nature. We do not see that things are impermanent, things are unsatisfactory, or things are insubstantial. It is manifested as the absence of right understanding, or as mental darkness. So it is a darkness. So if this room, there is no light in this room, then we cannot see things. So that is moha. Moha hiding the true nature of things. The opposite of moha is what? Amoha, right? The last mental factor. So amoha is compared to the light. So when you turn on the light, you see things here. Its proximate cause is unwise attention, ayoniso manasikara. Ayoniso manasikara is opposite of wisdom or panya. It should be seen as the root of all that is unwholesome, because as you know, moha accompanies all 12 types of akusala consciousness. So it is the root of all unwholesome, all that is unwholesome. Moha, avidya, sometimes anyana. Anyana means not jnana, not knowing. Okay, now the second one is ahirika, and the third one is anottabha. So ahirika is shamelessness, and anottabha is fearlessness of wrongdoing. No, shamelessness of wrongdoing, fearlessness of wrongdoing, actually. The characteristic of shamelessness is the absence of disgust at bodily and verbal misconduct. Now, ahirika is compared to a village pig, which is not disgust of eating excrement. So, when there is shamelessness or ahirika in our minds, we will not be disgusted at bodily misconduct or verbal misconduct. So we will not be ashamed, say, to break the precepts. We will not be ashamed to do what is immoral. And the characteristic of fearlessness of wrongdoing is absence of dread on account of such misconduct. So fearlessness means not being afraid of the consequences. I'm not afraid of the consequences, say, when I do something wrong. So that is because there is this mental factor of fearlessness in my mind. And this fearlessness is compared to a moth who is not afraid of the flame. That's why a moth just goes right into the flame and then gets itself burnt. So fearlessness of wrongdoing is compared to a moth, and shamelessness of wrongdoing is compared to a village pig. Both have the function of doing evil things. They are manifest as not shrinking away from evil. So when there are ahirika and anottabha in our minds, we are not ashamed to do immoral things, and we are not afraid of doing them. We don't care about their consequences. The approximate cause is the lack of respect for self, that is for shamelessness, and lack of respect for others. If we have self-respect, then we will not do what is immoral. And if we are not afraid of being criticized by others, we will not be afraid of doing wrong things. So, lack of self-respect is the proximate cause of ahirika, shamelessness, and lack of respect for others is the proximate cause of anottabha, fearlessness. And there are counterparts or the opposites of these two among the beautiful mental factors. I will come to them later. And then the fourth one is uddhaccha, restlessness. Here also restlessness means restlessness of mind. But when mind is restless, body may be restless too. But here Restlessness means not physical restlessness, but mental. So restlessness or agitation has the characteristic of disquietude. It is not quiet. Like water whipped up by the wind. So when there is wind and the water is not still, it has ripples or something like that. Its function is to make the mind unsteady, as wind makes a banner ripple. Yeah. A flag. You see the flag in the wind, and so it is fluttering. It is manifest as turmoil. Now, it is compared to ashes which rise up when a rock is thrown onto them. So when you throw a stone onto the heap of ashes, then the ashes rise up, and so it is clouded. The literal meaning of the word uddhaja is shaking above the object. That means your mind cannot take the objects properly. Your mind is not stuck to the object. It's a little removed from the object. Sometimes you don't see the objects clearly because of uddhaja. And also uddhaja is sometimes described as distraction. In Burmese, sometimes we say distraction for uddhaja. It is mind being not on the object. Its proximate cause is unwise attention to mental disquiet. That means not understand the real nature of the mental disquiet. So it doesn't care whether there is mental quietness or disquietness. So it is approximate cause of it. So these four are grouped as one. They are grouped as one group, because all these four are present with all 12 types of unwholesome consciousness. So whenever an unwholesome consciousness arises, these four also arise. So there is an element of ignorance or element of delusion, and then element of shamelessness and fearlessness, and also restlessness of mind when there is an unwholesome consciousness. So these four are called unwholesome universals. And then we have a group of three. They are lobha, dikti, and mana. So lobha is translated as greed, dikti as wrong view, and mana as conceit. Now you know lobha, right? Yeah, it's not new to you. Both the word and the and the chetasika itself. So greed, the first unwholesome root, covers all degrees of selfish desire, longing, attachment, clinging, craving. All these are shades of lobha. So you are desirous of something with selfish selfishness, then that is lobha. You long for something, lobha. You are attached to something, lobha. You cling to something, lobha. You crave for something lower. So all of these are included in lobha. Its characteristic is grasping an object, taking hold of an object. So when you are attached to something, your mind takes hold of that object. So it is characteristic is said to be grasping an object. Its function is sticking. As meat sticks to a hot pan. So you put a pan on the fire and it is hot and dry, and you throw a piece of meat and then the meat stick to the pan. So when there is lobha, your mind stick to that thing. If you want to get something very strongly, then you will see that your mind is stuck to that object or to that person. And lobha is, as to its characteristic, lobha is grasping an object, and it is compared to, what do you call that? Pitch. It's called pitch trap. You know, in order to catch monkeys, they use, pitch? A sticky substance from a tree. So glue or something like that. Yeah. And, it is a shiny surface. And so a monkey who is always curious about things just come and touch it with one hand and it can take the handbag. Then in order to get that hand free, he take hold of with the other hand, and then two hands are stuck there, then with one foot, and then with another foot, two four things, and then with the face or muscle, so all in all five places he's stuck to the pitch or to the glue, and so he was caught by the man and killed and eaten or something like that. So that simile was given in one of the discourses in the Sanyutta Nikaya. So there the Buddha said, in those spots, a hunter sets a trap of pitch in the monkey's track to catch the monkeys. Now those monkeys who are free from folly and greed on seeing that pitch trap keep far away from it. But a greedy, foolish monkey comes up to the pitch and handles it with one paw, and his paw sticks fast in it. Then thinking, I'll free my paw, he seizes it with another paw, but that too sticks fast. To free both paws, he seizes them with one foot, and that too sticks fast. To free both paws and one foot, he lays hold of them with another foot, but that too sticks fast. To free both paws and both feet, he lays hold of them with his muzzle, but that too sticks fast. So that monkey, thus trapped in five ways, or stuck in five places, lies down and howls, thus fallen on misfortune, fallen on ruin, a prey for the hunter to work his will upon him. So the hunter spits him and prepares him for eating there and then over the charcoal fire and goes off at his pleasure. So Buddha compared lobha to that sticky substance. It's called monkey. In Pali it is called monkey glue or something like that, because they catch a monkey with that kind of sticky substance from the trees. And next one is ditthi, wrong view. Now, the literal meaning of ditthi is just view or seeing. If we want to be specific, we use the words miccha or samma in front of the word. So miccha ditthi means wrong view, samma ditthi means right view. But when it is used alone, it mostly means wrong view. So that's why we have, say, somanasa sahagata dittigata sambyoda, right? We don't use miccha there. But actually, ditti there is miccha ditti. So ditti here, wrong view, seeing wrongly. Its characteristic is unwise or unjustified interpretation of things. So it takes things to be permanent, things to be satisfactory, things to be an Atman, something like that. And also it is belief that there is no There are no results of either good or bad karma, or there is a belief that there is no karma and there is no results of karma, and there is no this world, there is no other world, and so on. So these are called wrong views. And its function is to presume. That means to take wrongly. And it is manifested as a wrong interpretation or belief. Its proximate cause is unwillingness to see the noble ones, and so on. That means if you associate with noble ones, if you associate it with knowledgeable people, I mean good people, then you will hear from them the right views. And so you will not get wrong view. But if you do not associate with noble persons, good people, then you tend to get this deity or wrong view. So unwillingness to see the noble ones, to associate with them, is said to be a proximate cause of mitya deity, getting a wrong view. And then mana. Conceit has the characteristic of haughtiness. Its function is self-exaltation. It is manifested as vainglory. Its proximate cause is greed dissociated from views. It should be regarded as madness. So conceit is a kind of say, mental madness. And sometimes it is compared to a flag shaking in the wind. A flag, we put the flag up in the air, right? So we put it at the top of everything. So mana, the conceit, also wants to be at the top of, on top of other people. So it is called mana. Sometimes it may be overestimation of oneself. And its proximate cause is greed dissociated from views. Okay. Now, you'll see later that mana and deity do not coexist. When there is mana, there is no deity, and when there is deity, there is no mana. We will see that when we study the Chaita and Chaitasika combinations. That is why here it is said, proximate cause is greed dissociated from views. That means greed unaccompanied by wrong view. And then the next group, four, dosa quartet, say, group of four headed by dosa. Dosa, issa, macchariya, kukkucha. So, I gave you these handouts because I want you to be familiar with Pali names also, not just the English translation. So you have to know both Pali and English translations. So the first of the four is dosa. Dosa is translated as here hatred. Hatred, anger, ill will. So the second unwholesome root comprises all kinds and degrees of aversion, ill will, anger, irritation, annoyance, animosity, depression, sorrow. So all these are understood under hatred, I mean under dosa. Its characteristic is ferocity. So when there is dosa, you are very fierce. You are very rough. You are very cruel. So its characteristic is ferocity. And it is compared to a snake hit by someone. So when you hit a snake, then it, especially a cobra, then it will, what do you call, it will strike at you or try to strike at you. It will raise its head. So the dosa is like that. So when you are angry, it's like a cobra standing up. Its function is to spread or to burn up its own support. To spread means if you put poison, say, in water in something, when there is anger in you, hate in you, then it spread all over your mind, all over your mental makeup. So it is, its function is to spread. Or to burn up its own support, that is, the mind and the body in which it arises. So anger can burn your physical body as well as mental state. So anger can cause a person to get stroke. Sometimes that stroke is fatal. And anger can cause high blood pressure, so it can cause a lot of ailments, physical ailments. And also when there is anger in our mind is contaminated, and there is akusala. And anger, as a rule, leads to rebirth in hell. So its characteristic is ferocity, its function is to spread or to burn up its own support. That is the mind and body in which it arises. It is manifested as persecuting, I mean inflicting. So when you are angry, actually you are inflicted by that anger. Before you do anything to the other person, you are yourself inflicted by suffering. And its proximate cause is a ground for annoyance. Have I told you a ground for annoyance? I think so. Mm-hmm. Has done harm to me, thinking that way, I'm angry with you. Right? This person is doing harm to me. This person will do harm to me. Right? So the three, four, that kind of thing. And then, what next? This person has done harm to a person who is dear to me, right? Or he is doing harm to a person who is dear to me, or he will do harm to a person who is dear to me. And then, this person has done something good to the person I hate. Doing something good to the person I hate, or has done something, will do something good to the person I hate. So there are nine grounds of, what do you call that? Nine grounds of annoyance, nine grounds of anger, nine causes of anger. So thinking in one of these nine ways, say we get anger. So that is what is called here ground for annoyance, reasons for annoyance. Sometimes, that is true, right? Sometimes we don't like people we hate get something good. Now the next one is Issa, envy. Envy has the characteristic of being jealous of others' success. Now success really means anything. So his wealth, his appearance, his beauty, whatever it is. Its function is to be dissatisfied with others' success. So you don't like other people's success. It is manifested as aversion towards that. Its proximate cause is, again, others' success. So success means everything. That is it called jealousy, right? Jealous. And envy takes another person's success or another person's things as object. The next one will be different. Machariya, avarice. The characteristic of avarice or stinginess is concealing one's own success when it has been or can be obtained. That means with regard to what you already have. You have this kind of concealing. You want to conceal your property, your success, whatever. And also, sometimes, when you think that you are going to get something, you don't want that something to be common to other persons. Say, I'm going to get this thing. Before I get this thing, before it becomes my property, but I know that it's going to become my property, then I will not like you using this. And that is also macchariya. So macchariya takes the object which is already one's own property or which is going to be one's own property. And it is not able to bear sharing this property with other people. Macchariya is commonly understood as stinginess. I don't know what stinginess means. You don't want to lose anything. But here, macchariya will always arise with dosa mula citta. So it is not loba. So it is not really stinginess. It is not being able to bear to share your things with others. So when other person comes and make use of the thing you possess, you are angry, you don't like it. That is macchariya. Yeah, meanness, yeah. So we will find the word meanness down a little down. Its function is not to bear sharing these with others. It is manifest as shrinking away from sharing. So you don't want to share with other people. And as meanness or sour feeling, its proximate cause is one's own success. So it takes one's own property, one's own success as object. I don't want my property, my things, or my others to be shared by other people. So I want to use it only for myself. You remember the rich man who cooked cakes up on his house? He's called Macchariya Kosiya. So his name was Macchariya Kosiya. So he's very stingy. He cannot share his things even with his wife, right? he said, only for me you have to cook. Now, there are five kinds of macchariya. And they are, let us call macchariya avarice. So avarice with regard to dwelling place. That means when I'm living here, I don't want you to come and live with me. That is one kind of macchariya. I don't want to share my room with you, my house with you. And the second one is avarice regarding families. And that is mostly for monks, nuns, and recluses. Now, say, now you are my students. I want you to be my students only. I don't want you to be the student of other teacher. Something like that. I cannot bear to share you with other teachers. I want you to be my supporters. And I don't want you to support other monks. Something like that. So that is called the avarice regarding families. And then there is avarice regarding gains. Suppose I'm a famous monk, and I get the many things offered by people, and I want people to give to me only. I don't want you to give to other people, other monks. So that is a kind of avarice regarding gains, regarding things one gets. And then there is the avarice regarding one's own appearance. See, if I'm beautiful, I want to be beautiful only for myself. I don't want other people to be beautiful. And if I'm famous, I want to be famous only, myself only. So I don't want other people to be famous. That is avarice regarding one's appearance or one's fame. And the last one is avarice with regard to Dhamma. And Dhamma here means learning. I want to understand. I only want to, I don't know where to put only. I alone, they want to understand it. I don't want to share my understanding with you. I will keep my understanding to myself. And that is called avarice regarding Dhamma. So avarice or Machariya, that is why there is an element of hate or element of ill will in Machariya. That is why it will accompany only the two chaitas accompanied by dosa and not other chaitas accompanied by lobha or moha. So although it may be called stinginess, it is not attachment to things or to persons, but it is it cannot bear to share those things or those people with other persons. So that is what is meant by Machariya. Okay, the next one is what? Kukkuccha. Kukkuccha is worry or remorse after having done wrong. Now, there are two kinds of past actions, bad actions, good actions. Now, bad actions done in the past, with regard to these bad actions done in the past, you have remorse, you have regret. Oh, I've done that wrong thing, something like that. And also there is a remorse with regard to good things you did not do in the past. Oh, I should have done that, something like that. So here, worry or remorse has two kinds of objects. Good actions, good karma, as well as bad karma. Bad karma, which one has done in the past, and good karma, which one did not do in the past. So with regard to both, there is a kind of remorse or regret, and that is called kukkuccha. Its characteristic is subsequent regret. That means just regret after having done or after having not done. Its function is to sorrow over what has and what has not been done. So, oh, I've done this akusala, and then you sorrow over it. Or I have not done the kusala, and you sorrow over it. It is manifested as remorse. Its proximate cause is what has and what has not been done. Wrongs of commission and omission. So, we tend to get kukkuccha or remorse with regard to both things done and things undone. Now, this word kukkuccha has another connotation. You may not come across this connotation because it has to do with Vinaya. So in Vinaya literature, Kokucha can mean something. See, it's a good quality for monks to have kokucha. It is called Vinaya Kokucha. That means you try to find out or you try to understand whether it is allowed for monks or whether it is not allowed for monks, whether it is whether he can do this or he cannot do this. And if it is not allowable, then you do not do it. So that is also called kukkuja. It is vinaya kukkuja. But that is not akusala, this kukkuja. Sometimes it may be kusala. But that you find only in Vinaya and when describing the good monks. Say, he possesses a kind of Vinaya Kokucha or something like that. But in Abhidhamma here, Kokucha is akusala, unwholesome, and it is remorse. I prefer the word remorse to the word worry. Because worry may not necessarily be kukucha. If your worry is about the past actions, it may be kukucha. But sometimes you worry about the future, right? So worrying about the future is not kukucha. So I think remorse or regret is better than the word worry. Okay, these four are grouped together. And then the two, the twin, Tina and Middha, sloth and torpor. They always arise together. And so we call them sleepiness. So when you are sleepy or when your mind is not alert, then it is sure that sloth and torpor has come into your mind. So sloth is sluggishness or dullness of mind. That means consciousness. Its characteristic is lack of driving power. Its function is to dispel energy. It is manifested as a sinking of the mind. And its proximate cause is unwise attention to boredom, drowsiness, etc. Now this is the sluggishness of citta. And the next one, middha, is a morbid state of mental factors. That means sluggishness of mental factors, cetasikas. So one has to do with citta and the other with cetasikas. Since citta and cetasikas arise always together, they also arise together. They are never separated, tina and middha. But tina and middha are two separate mental factors. So when there is tina and middha, you don't want to do things, and so you are, your mind is not, not in a state of alert. So it is, its characteristic is said to be unwieldiness. So function is too smaller, and it is manifested as drooping, as nodding and sleepiness, and its proximate cause is the same as that of sloth. So sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor always occur in conjunction and are opposed to energy. So when you have energy, sloth and torpor cannot come into your mind. So when you are energetic, you do not feel sleepy. Sloth is identified as sickness of consciousness, citta, kilanya, and torpor as sickness of mental factors. So as a pair, they constitute one of the five hindrances which is overcome by vitaka, initial application. Now, there is one controversy about middha. I think, have you got the sheets on middha? Middha is not rupa. Have you got that chart? I mean, that sheet? Yeah? Ah, so, middha is not rupa. Some teachers who thought that middha is also rupa. There is a book called Vimuttimagga, and that is considered to be older than Visuddhimagga. But in that Vimuttimagga, metta is mentioned among the material properties. So, are you looking at that chart? I mean, that sheet? Yeah. So metta is mentioned as a material quality, not mental quality. There's a typing error there. So metta is mentioned as a material quality in Vimuttimagga. And Vimuttimagga is said to belong to one sect in Sri Lanka. So some say that metta also is rupa. So this metta is rupa, they said. And that is not correct, because the sense desire, etc., like sense desire, etc., it was included in those which should be eradicated. Now, in Abhidhamma, there are dhammas which are to be eradicated by the first enlightenment. And among them, not the first, they say first, second, third, fourth stages of enlightenment. So among them, metta is mentioned. Since metta is mentioned among those that can be eradicated, metta is not rupa, because rupa is said to be not said to be eradicable, cannot be eradicated. So, since metta is among, or since it is included in those that should be eradicated, metta cannot be a rupa. So metta is nama, metta is a mental factor. It is indeed mentioned by the Buddha among the hindrances that are to be eradicated. And this is giving support to his statement. But rupa is not stated among those that are to be eradicated by the first path, etc. So rupa is mentioned as not to be described, not to be eradicated. You'll find that in the sixth chapter. So metta cannot be rupa, because it is mentioned among those that can be eradicated. Then the other party said, because of the words, monks, rupa is not your own, give it up. There is a saying, this is a Buddha saying. So Buddha said, monks, rupa is not your own, give it up. So the other party picks up that sentence, that statement of the Buddha, and then argue against those that take metta to be nama. So since the Buddha said, rupa is not your own and give it up, there seems to be an indication that rupa could be eradicated. It is a dialogue. The other party also based his argument on the words of the Buddha. So Buddha said, yes, it is really there in the sutta. The Buddha said, rupa is not your own, so give it up. Then, let us say, the other party and our party, because our party is always correct. So then the explanation given by our party is, what the Buddha meant there is not to give up rupa, but to give up attachment to rupa. So attachment to rupa is meant when Buddha said, give it up. So the eradication of attachment, which has rupa as an object, was meant there. So what Buddha meant was not to give up your rupa, but to give up your attachment that takes rupa as an object. That is why it was said there. Because Buddha continued saying, throwing away of attachment to that rupa and so on, in the same discourse. So that is why it is very important that when we read something, we have to read the whole, not just a portion of it, and then make our conclusions. So in that sutta, Buddha did not just say, Rupa is not your own, give it up. But he continued to say that throwing away of attachment to that Rupa and so on and so on. So what is meant there is not to give up Rupa, but to give up attachment which takes that Rupa as object. Then the other party might say, among physical and mental matters. Now, they took that there are two kinds of matters. One, Rupa Meta, and the other, Nama Meta. One physical and one mental. So among these two physical and mental matters, mental meta was meant or preached there in that passage. So there is still another meta which is Rupa. That is what they would say. Then our party answered no, because it was not specifically said that mental meta was meant there. Buddha did not use the word mental meta, the word mental meta. Buddha used just meta. So since it is said meta and not with any specification, you cannot say that there are two metas and mental meta was meant there. Then the our body continues. It is possible to infer that meta, which you take to be rupa, is like mental meta, a hindrance, because it is meta. Since it is called meta, and meta is included among the mental hindrances. Mental hindrances are those that are to be eradicated. So it is a hindrance. Yet it is to be decided that metta is not rupa, because it was mentioned as a co-associate. It is another reason given by our party. Now, metta is said to be a co-associate. That means it is associated with consciousness. It is associated with other mental factors. And this co-association is mentioned of mental aggregates only. Only the mental aggregates, only the mental state, only the consciousness and mental factors are said to be co-associate. So mind is not said to be co-associate with matter, or matter is not said to be co-associate with mind. You will understand it when you study Pattana. So, metta is not rupa because it was mentioned as a co-associate. See, it was mentioned as a cetasika. Moreover, it cannot be rupa because of the text that mentions its arising in the arupa realm. Now, in Pattana, it is stated that metta arises in the minds of formless Brahmas, arupa vachara Brahmas. Since metta is mentioned as mentioned among states that arise in formless beings, it must be nama and not rupa, because there is no rupa in formless states. Then it may be the last one. The other body said, what about arahants going to sleep? Isn't it Tina and Meta? So the answer is, sleep of arahants who are free from mental defilements is caused by the fatigue of the physical body. Now, when arahants, say, we say arahants go to sleep, when they go to sleep, it is not because of Tina and Meta, because they have eradicated Tina and Meta altogether. But when their body becomes fatigued, when their body becomes tired, then owing to the weakness of that body, sentient body, their mind leaps into bhavanga, life continuum, sleep-like thought process. I mean, not thought process, sleep-like series of consciousness. So, owing to the fatigue and weakness of the physical body, these arahants' mind leaps into life continuum. And that is what we call sleep of arahants. So, when arahants go to sleep, they don't go to sleep like we do. When we go to sleep, we go to sleep with Tina and Medha. Tina and Medha come to us, and then we just surrender to them, and then they overpower us, and we go to sleep. But when arahants go to sleep, they sleep not because they are overpowered by Tina and Medha, but because their bodies become tired, and so the physical body really needs some kind of rest. And so the sleep of arahants is not caused by or not accompanied by Tina and Medha. And so you cannot say that Medha is Rupa. So this is the opinion of majority of teachers in the ancient days. And according to the Abhidhamma we are studying, according to Theravada Abhidhamma, Medha is not Rupa, Medha is not physical, Medha is mental. And so Medha is a mental factor, and it is included in the mental factors that accompany unwholesome types of consciousness. The last one, doubt. Vichikicca. Have you met Vichikicca before? Where? Akusala citta, right. Which Akusala citta? Number 11 or 12? Huh? 11 or 12? 12? Oh, one says 11 and another is 12. So there's a, there's a class. Yeah? It's 11. Okay. So doubt. The consciousness accompanied by doubt is the 11th or the first of the two accompanied by moha, right? Yeah, you look at the chart. Okay, now doubt here signifies spiritual doubt. From a Buddhist perspective, the inability to place confidence in the Buddha. So doubt about the Buddha, about the Dhamma, about the Sangha, and the training. Training means training of sila, samadhi, and panya. And also it is doubt about aggregates, bases, and elements in the past, in the future, both in the past and future, and also doubts about the teaching of dependent origination. Its characteristic is doubting. Its function is to waver. So when there is doubt, you waver between two or three. You cannot choose one of them. So you are not sure this or this. It is manifested as indecisiveness. So you cannot decide which is correct or something like that. Like when you are at a crossroads, you do not know which way to take. And as taking various sides, that means falling to one side or another side. Right. Its proximate cause is unwise attention. Now, here doubt means the doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and so on. Sometimes, say, at the crossroads, you are not sure whether to turn left or right. And that doubt is not akusala doubt. It's just lack of understanding. It is not akusala doubt. Even arahants can have such doubts. Sometimes even they don't know whether a particular action is allowable or not, if they are not well-versed in Vinaya. So not every doubt is vichikicca. According to, in a Buddhist perspective, the manual said, so from a Buddhist perspective, it is doubt about the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So if you have doubt about the Buddha, whether there was a Buddha at all, or whether Buddha really possessed omniscience, or whether Buddha was really enlightened, or something like that. So such kinds of thinkings are called doubt. And this doubt is described in Visuddhimagga and Atthasarini as doing harm to the practice. Now, the English translations, both of Atthasarini and Visuddhimagga, are a little inaccurate. The Pali sentence used there is patipatti antaraya kara. That means doing harm to patipatti. You know patipatti? You have heard this word many times. No, not sharing well. Patipatti means practice. The practice of meditation, or practice of duties, practice of keeping precepts also. So that is called patipatti. Now, the word patipatti in Pali has two meanings. It also means understanding. So one person translated as